Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.
The New Statesman.
Hi, I'm Anoush.
I'm Bruno.
And I'm Ben.
And this is the New Statesman's politics podcast. Today we're going to be looking at some of the biggest elections taking place around the world in 2024 and their implications for democracy. Hello, I'm Anoush Shekelian, Britain editor at the New Statesman and host of this podcast. And joining me down the line, I have New Statesman foreign correspondent Bruno Musaish, who has written the upcoming cover story on the year of voting dangerously. Also joining down the line is senior data journalist Ben Walker. 2024 is set to be the biggest election year in history. Countries with more than 4 billion people will be sending their citizens to the polls. Last week on the podcast, we had a look at how elections would shape Britain in 2024. And now we're going to turn our attention to some of the other political forces at play around the globe. So we'll start with the US, because that's probably the one that's on most of our listeners' minds after the UK general election, which we expect will probably take place this year. That's due in November. Ben, who are the key candidates we should be watching and how are they polling at the moment? You've been looking at the polling closely.
Who are the key candidates? The ones we had last time, really. It's no change here. Joe Biden, of course, the incumbent, is... all indications, despite some pressure from some sections last year to see him step down. He's going to be the Democratic incumbent, the new candidate, and of course Donald Trump, who is presently cruising to a sort of easy win amongst his Republican base. And this is what we need to know about the Republican base. It's not what it used to be 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's a completely different voter now. It's a lot more... conservative is the wrong word. Populist is probably better. It's types of voters who are a bit more reactionary, who aren't necessarily economically right wing, but socially so, absolutely. And Trump, among this rather reactionary base, is cruising to a steady win. If you look at 538, their own polling averages, my goodness, Trump's on like 60-something%. There's no debate on who's going to get the nomination. You'd think perhaps his, being removed off the Colorado ballot. So, you know, when the presidential election comes, he's not going to be on the ballot. People in Colorado are not going to be able to vote for him. You'd thought that might have changed something, but it doesn't seem to have done anything there. It seems quite, if you look at the polling, he's gone up from around about 40 to 60 and he's just stayed there for months on end. And then you have other people, and we like to try to make great hay of the other candidates. You have Nikki Haley, who's, well, really, she surged from 4% last month to 8% now, which really, when you consider Trump's on 60%, isn't telling you much, is it? So it's going to be Biden versus Trump again. And if I may just say, I know we're recording this in January, the first few days of January 24, the election's in November. And I would say this, that not to be a snobby Brit, but US polling isn't amazing. And it hasn't been for quite a while. There's a lot of pollsters, a lot of market research firms, and the dedication to publishing the data tables, the transparency, you know, the follow-up questions isn't perhaps as great as it is in the UK. In the UK, we have something called the British Polling Council. If you want to be, you know, like respected by people like Britain Elects, you publish the data tables so we can see the questions, so we can see the sampling, so we can see what you've done. And those are the pollsters I give credence to. I don't give credence to anyone else. In the US, there's no real regulation like that. And it's not really even a regulation. It's just quite a free-for-all and, you know, a gentleman's agreement. They don't have that in America. And as such, the polling is a bit too varied. And sometimes you just don't know the question wording that is actually put to respondents, put to the sample, and it's very quite frustrating indeed. So what I would say this far out, US presidential election polling is a bit poor. It's not entirely a great predictor. Nevertheless, the feeling felt towards President Biden is poor. If you compare how Biden polls to Trump, Obama, Bush, all the rest of them, he's not doing particularly great. And the reason he's not doing great is because his base isn't that enthused with him. And there's a lot of voter uncertainty right now amongst those that backed Biden. Let's not forget, Biden won off a coalition of votes, coalition of, you know, black conservatives, moderate voters, as well as liberals who were willing to swallow the fact that he wasn't Bernie Sanders, he wasn't Elizabeth Warren. They were willing to all coalesce around him with the primary purpose of defeating Donald Trump. Now, that was 2020. That was when Trump was president. That was when Trump was the incumbent, where, you know, if you're dissatisfied with the status quo, you can vote for Biden. We don't have that now. And there are plenty of Americans out there who really sort of see Biden as not handling things well, so much so that they're either not voting altogether, and they used to be Biden supporters, or they're switching to Trump. Very few of them, but they do exist. And that's why the polling for Biden personally isn't great. And though polling this far out isn't accurate, it does suggest Biden's got a bit of a challenge going up, because being not Trump was enough in 2020, but I don't know if it's going to be enough in 2024.
Great. Thanks, Ben, for taking us through the landscape in terms of polling. And Bruno, Ben mentioned Colorado, the state of Colorado ruling that Trump is ineligible to hold office, and the state of Maine has made the same decision. I mean, how likely is it that more states will follow? And is there any scenario in which he might be disqualified from running at all, do you think?
It seems from the news yesterday that Trump is appealing to the Supreme Court. I think he was worried not particularly about Colorado, but about other states, and that this could spread.
Mm.
I expect the Supreme Court to strike down these disqualifications from the states for, you know, for legal reasons, that there's still Trump has been indicted, but it hasn't been there hasn't been a verdict from a court accusing him of subverting the Constitution or rebellion, which is what is being discussed. Now, I think there are also political reasons. People are genuinely uncomfortable, even people on the left, with the idea that a candidate could be disqualified.
Yeah.
Rick Grenell, who may well be Trump's next Secretary of State, compare what happened in Colorado to what's happening in Pakistan, where Imran Khan, the former prime minister, has been disqualified from running for the next election. And, you know, he made a point that I think people on the left have to agree to some extent, that if this happened in another country, about which people wouldn't know much, the reaction in the West would have been that this is the usual attempt to subvert democracy by disqualifying the opposition leader, which Trump obviously is. So I think many people would be uncomfortable with that idea. On the other hand, I think we have to agree with those who look at what happened in 2020. See, Trump tried to upturn the result of the election. Not only with January 6th, about which there's still a lot of debate, but with those phone calls to Georgia, trying to influence election officials to change the results. And then you have to ask, if he did that when he was not in office, what can he do if he is the next president? And will the U.S. still have three elections in 2028? Robert Kagan published a very controversial piece in the Washington Post saying this is the end of American democracy. And I don't think we should laugh. I met a couple of think tankers in D.C. 2 weeks ago, and I was still arguing that the U.S. has a robust democracy that has proven itself over decades, centuries. And they kind of laughed and saying, this is the debate from 4 years ago. But now we have to realize and confront a real possibility that Trump will have no obstacles left at that point, and he will have a kind of drive to change the system and to perpetuate his power. So to give you an example, do we know that Trump won't run for a third term? Why not? Will the Supreme Court be able to face him? Will he respect the decision from the Supreme Court on this? He's been quite outspoken about how this time around it's about populating the administrative state, as he calls it, with his own loyalists. So I think the moment is very dangerous, and we're faced with the typical predicament of democracy that makes us think of Weimar Germany, where do you sort of use the Constitution to exclude these anti-democratic forces, or do you prefer to gamble that you'll be able to defeat them democratically? I think that's what the United States is right now.
And you've talked about the implications for American democracy. How about the implications for democracies around the world? Because you make the point in your cover piece about how there's a tendency in the West to see Western democracies like the US as a sort of model for other countries to follow. But you're saying that that norm, or at least that assumption, just cannot be relied upon anymore.
Yeah, this has puzzled me for a long time. I remember when Mike Pompeo, Trump's Secretary of State, he was quite schizophrenic how he dealt with the question of democracy. Because when he traveled around the world, he was still the traditional American official, foreign policy official, talking about the importance of the free press and talking about respecting electoral procedures. But then when he's back home, he was attacking the press as being enemies of the people. And he was supporting Trump in many of his attempts to overturn the election result. And I think this is the contradiction that many people still live in. Even Robert Kagan in his piece will say that America is on the path. He makes it sound like the inevitable path to autocracy. But then he thinks American global leadership is still important. So is he actually arguing that an autocratic America should still be a global leader? Or do countries around the world have to start worrying with a scenario where the U.S. And American power, which was in many respects tolerated or welcomed because of the strong nature of American democracy, if that goes away, I think our reaction towards American power will have to change. So this is not just about what happens domestically in the U.S. It's about the current world order as well, and how the changes in America will necessarily force changes in the distribution of power globally.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's move on to Russia. There will be presidential elections, if you can call them that, in March this year. Putin's been president since 2012. He will be running for re-election, and he can do this because he made constitutional amendments so that he could do so, like you were describing, Bruno, might happen under Trump if he gets in again. Ben, you were talking about the paucity of American polling. Is there anything that we can glean from public opinion in Russia that will tell us how people truly feel about the war or about how they feel about Putin and his reputation?
Yeah. There was a strata of thought, I think, in the immediacy of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2022, when people kept saying, well, you can't trust any public opinion polls in Russia because there aren't any, because, well, there's a fear factor of, you know, if you're declaring an opinion to an opinion poll, you're telling the truth, and other issues that, you know, kind of, what would you say, suffocate genuine public feeling. There is perhaps some truth in that, but I don't think it's an easy excuse to say, you know, Russian public opinion is generally quite occasionally nationalistic. There is that reality we have to sort of accept. So when it comes to opinion polls for the presidential election, I don't really think they're worth any damn. I think we know what the result is going to be. Vladimir Putin's going to cruise to a re-election victory by whatever margin. But I would just notice this. When the war in Ukraine began, you did have some people try to go into Russia, try to get some decent quality data from the Russian public, try to make it representative of actual feeling. And the truth of the matter is that I think Westerners like us perhaps need to realize is that there is actually quite a bit of support for what was the special military operation, how there was some nationalistic fever, there was a sense of that does exist in Russia. You know, Putin didn't win, you know, hasn't always won via, you know, rigging votes. There has been that feeling in Russia that has been pro him for a, you know, at the start at least. And so this idea that the Russian people are waiting to sort of, you know, see him out, I think is for the birds. Nevertheless, there is undoubtedly a, I don't know, a roundabout between a quarter to a third of the Russian public who do not, aren't best keen on him, who do want to see him out. And there were some parliamentary elections a few years back in, I think it was 2021, when Navalny urged everyone to vote tactically. So, you know, in one seat, you should vote for this candidate, a really nationalistic candidate. In another, you should vote for the Communist Party candidate, who are just as nationalistic, really. This was the way to, you know, deal Putin a blow and all the rest of it. And a lot of Russians did feel like they could do that. Although that was one instance where, you know, the end result was in certain seats in Moscow, particularly, the result was a far cry from how people cast their ballots. Now, if you want to oppose Putin in Russia, you're not going to be like, you know, a copycat. Well, you're not going to be a copy and paste job of a liberal in the West. You're going to be, you know, you could be right wing, you could be quite nationalistic as well, and you could be something else. And that's what we saw in those parliamentary elections, which didn't, you know, bear out to hit Putin at all. But to get back to the issue, no, Putin's going to cruise to a re-election, whatever polling we have there.
Thanks. Bruno, do you think anything will be different this time round? Not necessarily in the election result, but do you think anything among the Russian public and Putin's standing has changed?
I think he's having more difficulty orchestrating the internal consensus between different forces because there's now an emerging opposition from the right, nationalist opposition, that thinks he's not being tough enough and that he should have finished the war by now. So that makes it more difficult for him within the elite circles to make everyone happy. But it's not a democratic question for Putin or for Russia. Now, many people still argue that the turnout numbers might be poor and they are somewhat more difficult to falsify. And if turnout is incredibly low, they'll be seen as a blow to Putin. Although I'm sure he will be able to present even that as just the fact that people didn't vote because they are happy with the state of Russia right now. So I don't think it's a really important election. And I actually think we probably in Western media should try to avoid making the mistake of presenting it as a real election.
Mm.
It wasn't in the past and this time around even less. What's really important for Russia is what's happening in Ukraine. Whether Russia gains the upper hand or whether it continues to face difficulties. And that if it continues to face difficulties, then Putin will be in trouble, but not through the election. In any case, let's keep an eye on the turnout and see what happens there.
After the break, we'll be looking at India and Taiwan. If you're subscribed to The New Statesman, you can get all of our episodes ad-free on the New Statesman app. You can get it on both iOS and Android. Just search for New Statesman on the App Store or Google Play Store. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support The New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.
Trust in politics is broken, so can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance is completely left politics. Yeah.
Together, we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.
And on to India, which I think will be particularly interesting. General elections are expected to be held there between April and May. And according to the current polling, the BJP, which is Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party, remains in pole position. I mean, what would a third term for Modi mean for the country, Bruno?
Yes, I've talked to Indian opposition politicians in my last visit 3 or 4 months ago. And in private, they are quite gloomy about not just the prospects for them, but the prospects for Indian democracy. Mm. What they usually argue is that Modi is still not all powerful at the state level, where the BJP in many states still has difficulties. But at the national level, there's really no significant opposition. The Congress is very diminished. The Indian National Congress, and there hasn't really been the emergence of a powerful candidate to face Modi in the elections this year. And I think it might even be impossible because Modi just takes the air out of everyone else in the opposition, but also in the BJP itself. So I do think there is a danger that if Modi wins again, the BJP will have another term to consolidate their power at the state level, and that things might become very difficult in the future. Now, to some extent, people in the BJP argue, and I think it's true, that some of these dynamics are due just to the weakness of the opposition and its inability to pull its act together, to consolidate its forces, to appeal to the median Indian voter. A dynamic similar to what we've seen in Turkey, where also Erdogan's rise is connected to the sad state of the Turkish opposition. And this is part of the democratic game, one has to say. The opposition simply has to get better. And we see that there's still this dependence on the old traditional families, which is something I talk about in the piece.
Yeah.
So Rahul Gandhi has shown over and over again that he's not a very effective candidate, but he's still around after losing the elections last time because he comes from this distinguished political family in India. So, you know, either the BJP consolidates its power or the opposition after another election gets its act together. But things are moving in India, that's for sure.
Yeah. And Ben, you've been looking closely at the numbers on this. I mean, is anything jumping out to you?
Yes, similar to what Bruno says. Wherever Modi exists, no one else does. He sucks out the ability for others to get in. Nevertheless, last election, for those unaware, let me get the numbers up here. You know, there's 500 and something seats for the Indian Parliament. Last election, Modi's party came away with 290, okay, which is, you know, you get your majority there. He's got the majority. And right now he's probably cruising to some sort of re-election with an increased majority, although really we don't really know by much. So he's got 290 now. You need 270 to win a majority. Polling puts in between, you know, 290 and 350. Okay, it's pretty big variation there. Now the opposition, yes, they've lost the past few general elections quite convincingly. And what's happened with the oppositions is they've all bandied together to form an INDIA party, also known as India Alliance, rather, which is just a collection. It's a real big tent of various parties. You've got the main opposition, the Indian National Congress, who don't perform well on their own, but you've also got a bunch of communist parties. You've got the those advocating for greater autonomy in Kashmir. You've got a ton of them, all with the rather united goal of defeating Modi. Now, in when you do look at the polling, the seat projections are pretty poor for them. They're probably about a 100 to 200 seats out from winning. They're not really doing particularly well. But I would note this: when you do poll people based on which party they'll support, you know, get your proportion, you know, share of support. Modi's alliance, they come away with around about 40 to 45%. Of support, and this new anti-Modi, if you want to call it that, India Alliance comes away with around about between 38 and 40%. Right now, based on those numbers alone, that sounds rather close, doesn't it? But in seat terms, you know, it is a first past the post. It doesn't really work like that. And so, yeah, but the you know, if you just look at, you know, who people are supporting, you'd think, oh, maybe it could be close. But I don't think I know India that well to say it could be. It's just based on these numbers alone, it does look it, but I doubt it.
Thank you. And I do think we should talk about Taiwan, which will be heading to the polls later this week. So before the magazine and before your piece is out, Bruno. But how to deal with China is the central theme of the current campaigns ahead of this election. And Bruno, you spent some time in Taiwan with Taiwanese officials recently, didn't you? And you write, my most vivid impression from a recent visit to the island was that Taiwan represents a unique democracy because by necessity or choice, it has fully embraced the dangers of democratic rule. And can you explain what you mean by dangers there and also your impressions from your visit?
You know, there's this old idea that democracies can function very well in normal times. That's where they excel. But in dark times, in times of war, in times of conflict, internal conflict or external conflict, that perhaps you need another kind of arrangement. This is a very popular argument. And, you know, history hasn't decided whether this is true or not. Certainly in wars, democracies take their time to get their act together, but eventually they did in World War II. But the case of Taiwan is particularly difficult because what you have is a vibrant democracy that has to make decisions of an existential nature. Have to make decisions about how many risks do we run that could lead us to a catastrophic war. What does it mean to be Taiwanese? Are we responsible for a possible world thermonuclear war if we don't play our cards well? And what impressed me in Taiwan was they're dealing with this very well, but it's a rather exceptional circumstances. And if that in our own democracies in Europe, we are nowhere these sort of debates and these sort of discussions. In Britain, I suppose, there's a lot of discussion about housing policy and what to do about it. In Portugal and many other countries in Europe, where I'm from, the discussion is even more confined. Sometimes the discussion is whether the VAT tax is going to be 23 or 24%, because Brussels has assimilated many of the national powers. And then you go to Taiwan, and the discussion is about, do we risk the possibility of war in order to save our independent lifestyle? Are we Taiwanese or Chinese? And this is incorporated into the electoral process. Now, I thought this was, in a way, very edifying for our image of what democracy can do. And that's how I finished the piece saying, you know, let's hope this lasts, but it's quite extraordinary to see that a democracy can actually deal with these issues. And then what is the alternative? I mean, my take would be, my final take in the piece would be there, the more important the issue is, the more important that the method to decide it be democratic. So there's something quite perverse about saying this is too important to leave it to the people. And Taiwan is proving that if it is important, then that's precisely what it should be left to the people.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's just so many other elections that we could be talking about, the European Parliament and potentially elections in Israel and Ukraine as well. We don't have time on this particular episode to go through them all, but I do encourage all of our listeners to go and pick up a copy of The Next New Statesman, where Bruno's piece laying out the implications of some of these votes will fill you in with even more detail than we have in this conversation. But I just want to, as it's the New Statesman podcast, I just want to end on Ben's idea of what he thinks, which one of these elections or any of these trends could have the most implications for UK politics, because there is some fear that our election could run concurrently to the US one.
We don't really have major elections in one single European country pertaining to the European Union, but we have the European elections. And one thing you need to notice there is how many times have we done think pieces, op-eds about the death of the radical right or national populism or conservatism? It's really exhausting. You look at the latest projections in the European Parliament, the far right are set to, you know, it's going to be their, you know, as a piece of the pie, the far right is set to, you know, get their largest share ever. You know, right now, they're set to increase the number of their seats in the European Parliament by 20 to 40. That's big. And you would have thought, you know, once upon a time, it was the UK with UKIP who had the radical right. They were the main proponents of that type of politics there. No. What we're going to see in the European Parliament is quite a decent gain from the radical right there. And I don't think that those ideas, those radical right parties are dead or gone. I just want to see in which countries they do well, particularly in Sweden, in Germany with the AfD, they've sort of taken over where the old radical left used to be in East Germany. You look at projections in Germany right now and you'll always notice the AfD are winning literally where the radical left used to win. And I want to see how well, of course, Le Pen's or whoever succeeds Le Pen does well in France. And is Meloni, Giorgia Meloni in Italy, she's relatively popular now. Is she going to sort of get that confidence boost? Is she doing well? Is she going to sort of get an abstract mandate in a European Parliament election victory? I don't know, but I think, you know, it's likely that Keir Starmer will be the next UK Prime Minister. It's likely that we're going to have another Labour victory. What that UK Labour government does in dealing with European countries who are, you know, more and more willing to entertain the radical right is going to be very interesting. You know, it seems as though whilst the UK is rapidly choosing to regret its Euroscepticism, other countries in Europe are, well, willing to engage some of it, aren't they?
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thanks so much, both of you, for joining me. It was great to have you, and Happy New Year. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shekelian, and my colleagues, Bruno Masaish and Ben Walker. You can read Bruno's cover story in the upcoming issue of the New Statesman and find it on the New Statesman website next week. This episode was produced by Catherine Hughes.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.
Trust in politics is broken. So can we get UK politics working again?
That was the last time we were happy. 2012.
I'm Beth Rigby, Sky's political editor. Join me every week with Labour's Jess Phillips and Conservative peer Ruth Davidson for some electoral dysfunction.
This idea of nuance has completely left politics. Yeah.
Together we'll focus on the policies that could deliver political satisfaction. Follow Electoral Dysfunction wherever you get your podcasts.